Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome along. It's so lovely to see faces that I know, but new faces as well. So welcome along to today's end of year office support lunch for Christmas, and thank you all for coming along. So, firstly, we'd like to say a very big welcome to Susan Key. Kay, just because you said I sat there going, Susan Kay. So thank you, Sue, for your time and ongoing support for professional development of office professionals and for agreeing to share with us today. I would also like to respectfully acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which this event is taking place and elders both past and present. I also recognise those whose ongoing effort to protect and promote Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures and will leave a lasting legacy for future elders and leaders. So just some housekeeping. In case of an emergency, follow the instructions from the Tattersall staff. Yep. Use of facilities, so restrooms, if you don't know, you go straight out the door, walk all the way down the corridor, and they're on your left. All right. So we are very, very excited to have Susan here today. What we'll do, Sue will make her presentation and then afterwards have a think about any questions that you'd like to ask. Even better, there's some pens and papers on everybody's table, so write down some questions as you go, and then we'll have a little break for a couple of minutes after the presentation, and then we'll go around with the mic. So anybody who would like to ask some questions can do that at that point. And please feel free to do so. Yes? Jolly good. Recognised as one of RoboHub's 2018 Women in Robotics You Need to Know About, as one of Queensland's most influential people, and as a superstar of STEM, Sue combines science with business. She runs the world's first robotic vision research centre and developed Australia's first robotics roadmap. Could I please ask everybody to welcome Sue Kay.
Thank you very much for having me here. And I was delighted to get an invitation to be here from Dillis because, you know, although I work with robots, most of my direct staff who are the glue that holds the centre together are office support staff. And if you were to come and visit our lab, you would see why they are not going to be replaced by robots anytime soon. But it is the time when robots are coming. So what does that mean? Well, a lot of you are probably thinking that it's about time that the robots were here, because it looks like many of you in the room are too young to remember when this movie first came out, but this is from Star Wars. I remember this movie because I was a child when this came out, and I think that it really captured everyone's imagination about the different possibilities that robots could hold for the future and some of the exciting things that we could see robots doing, being our companions, helping us with doing tasks. Unfortunately, those sort of movies have given us quite unrealistic expectations of what robots can do, and there's a very simple reason for that. I hope this is not spoiling anyone's idea of what was going on in Star Wars, but unfortunately, Star Wars, most of the original movies, they are actually people in metal suits pretending to be robots. They're not real robots. And so they're not really showing us what robots can do, they're showing us what people dressed up in metal suits can do. So we have a completely false impression of what robots can do. Robots and humans are very different. Robots can do some things that humans can't do so well. Humans can still do a lot of things that robots can't do at all. And yes, our impressions of them, though, are quite different, and that's understandable because they're shaped by what we see on the screen. So, for example, I mean, who actually saw a robot on their way to the Christmas lunch today? Anyone? No, I mean, because they're still not very common out in the world amongst us. So, you know, we can only rely on what we see in these movies to give us some sense of what their capabilities are. But if you work in a robotics lab like I do, you learn to feel quite sorry for your robots because they are much more limited in capability than you might expect. One of the latest Star Wars movies is actually the first Star Wars movie that features a real robot. So R2-D2 and C-3PO, unfortunately, were not real robots, but BB-8 actually is a real robot. So it's great to see some robots being properly depicted on screen by robots. And hopefully, I guess probably the capabilities of that robot are overstated, but maybe in the future we'll actually see some robots that actually are behaving as robots do in the real world. But I asked that question about whether you had seen any robots. If any of you live down near the port of Brisbane, or if you have the opportunity to fly in and out of Brisbane, you can definitely see some robots. But they probably don't look like robots that you see in the movies. So the truth is that robots are actually already here. You might just not see them. The Port of Brisbane was the world's first port to be automated. And so if you ever get the chance to have a look out the window as you're flying out of Brisbane, this is what you'll see. These are called automated straddle carriers. You don't have any people on the docks when these are in operation. You have people in a control centre, which is fenced off from this area, but you just have these robots that roam around the dock, take the containers to where they need to go, load them on the trucks. The truck drivers actually move away from their vehicles when the straddle carriers are in operation. As you can see here, it's just loading up one of the trucks. And all of that is done without people having to do any of the movement of that material. Another example here in Australia is a company called Fastbrick Robotics, which is based in Western Australia and is listed on the Australian Stock Exchange. And as you can see, it is developing a bricklaying robot. Now, I don't know whether any of you know or have relatives who are bricklayers, but unfortunately, it's really not a very good occupation in terms of your back. So not many bricklayers can work past the age of 50. So you can see that this is probably a great use for a robot to be applied to, because it's taking people out of one dangerous but also very labour-intensive job that can result in physical injury. But despite that, you're probably wondering, that's fine. If I work at a port, or if I'm, you know, somewhere on a construction site, maybe I'd see a robot, but I still haven't seen any today. Where are they all? And this footage is of one of the most sophisticated car manufacturing plants in the world. This is from Fremont, California. It's the Tesla car manufacturing plant. And we've actually had robots in manufacturing and in car manufacturing plants since the 1960s. So in that respect, robots really aren't a very new technology for that industry. And yet, if you were to time travel back to 1960 and go and visit a car manufacturing plant, and then compare it with what you see here in this Tesla car manufacturing plant, and you see they've got some wonderful robots there. They give them inspirational names like Wolverine and Colossus. They can move things around, they can be used for welding. But in general, hopefully we'll go back to the main picture. In general, you are seeing some people in that picture, but on the production line here, you do not see any people. In fact, you can see that those robots are all in individual cells with walls around them. They are essentially caged off so that people can't get anywhere near them, because those robots have no capability to change what they're doing if a person gets in their way, and that's dangerous. So one of the reasons that you don't see robots out and about in the world amongst us is because that's still a problem that we're trying to solve. And the reason that that problem hasn't been solved is because robots traditionally haven't been very good at operating in what we call unstructured environments. So compare that in a manufacturing plant, you can control precisely where everything is, what material is moving in and out, where people are located. That's fantastic for robots. But we need robots in areas like construction, where people are also having to do a lot of manual labour. But on a construction site, you can imagine materials can be coming and going. People, different trades people can be coming and going at all different times of the day. That is much harder for a robot to respond to. And it's very much the same in an office environment. We would call that an unstructured environment. People are moving from place to place. You don't just get up and have a coffee at exactly 10:15. Although, I don't know, does anyone do that? But unless you were to have such a structured routine, it makes it really hard for a robot to work next to you, because it's not, you know, it then has to kind of figure out, what are you going to do next? Are you getting up to get a coffee, or are you going to go to the photocopier, or are you going to go get some printing? What's going on? What are you doing? And that is actually a very sophisticated level of understanding, much more of a sort of understanding that we humans have without even really thinking about it. And so that's where our centre comes in. So we're a national research centre based, headquartered here at QUT, but with other university partners and also some international partners. And our sole aim is to give robots the capability to be able to operate safely out in the world amongst us. Okay? And what do we need to do that? Well, there are two things that have been very important. One is nothing that we've had anything to do with, and that's just that In general, computer processing power means that robots are reaching a tipping point where they can actually process a lot of the information that they need to be able to respond in unstructured environments and to behaviours that they might not have experienced before. Okay, so that's been very important. But what we're doing is we're trying to give robots the capability to see. So we're applying something called computer vision to the robots. Computer vision is just a fancy way of saying, you know, how you get a computer to recognize an image. And you probably all would have seen this if you have a Facebook account. And Facebook will have a pretty good go at trying to figure out who all your friends are. And when it can't figure it out, it then enlists your help, and then it learns from what you've done. That's computer vision. Now, we need for robots to be able to interpret that same sort of visual information if we want them to operate in unstructured environments. So that's what we're doing. We're creating what we call robotic vision. It's the ability of robots to see. And cameras, of course, are everywhere. Cameras are very cheap, and so it's an easy solution for robots to be able to use, as long as they are capable of processing all of the visual data that we give them to be able to make intelligent decisions that are safe for people. So I don't have any examples, or I will get onto social robots, but I'm going to show you an example which you might find a little bit hard to apply in the environment that you work in, but hopefully it'll just give you an idea of what are the advantages that a robot has when you can give it vision. So one of our most famous robots is the robot pictured here, which is called Cotspot, our crown of thorns starfish robot. And on the left there is a picture of a crown of thorns starfish, and that's our vision algorithm in action. It's identified the crown of thorns starfish, and the robot is injecting that starfish with a toxin. Now, before you get worried about that, if you don't know, crown of thorns starfish, although it's a native organism, it eats coral. And unfortunately, since we've had agriculture along the east coast of Australia, the numbers of crown of thorns starfish in the Great Barrier Reef have really exploded. They eat coral. So they're actually responsible for 40% of the degradation of the Great Barrier Reef. They're literally eating all of the coral. And there's not a lot we can do about that unless we were to get rid of agriculture along the east coast of Australia, which is not likely to happen anytime soon. So in the meantime, what we have to do is try and control their numbers. And the only way that we can do that is by injecting them with a toxin. When I say toxin, it's actually pretty simple. It's as simple as vinegar. So James Cook University discovered that if you inject these starfish with vinegar, it attacks their protein structure, the starfish dies, doesn't hurt anything else on the reef. But the only way that you can administer that toxin before we developed this robot was to send human divers down to inject every single starfish. Now, unfortunately, we have human divers die every year because scuba diving is inherently unsafe. Not only that, it's not economic for those human divers to clear crown of thorns starfish in any areas except areas where tourists go. So the Australian Marine Park Tourism Authority pays human divers to go down and clear areas of our reef, but the rest of our reef, which is the size of Italy, no one is doing anything about. And that's just because they can't. Now, where robots can be really useful is for problems like this where you have to scale, and you can't scale by just using human labour alone. And so we developed this prototype robot to demonstrate whether we could do this task. And we were able to demonstrate that we can. So this is actually the robot in operation. So you can imagine that the Great Barrier Marine Park Authority had some... This is actually a human diver is showing the robot around and helping it to be trained to recognise crown of thorns starfish. You can imagine the Great Barrier Marine Park Authority was really concerned about us having these robots on the reef and what were we going to be injecting. We had to be able to assure them that, you know, it was 100% that our identification of the crown of thorns starfish was 100% successful. So there's our vision algorithm in action. It's identified a crown of thorns starfish. The robot then has to kind of position itself in just the right way so that it can apply the injection. We designed the robot's injection system by putting GoPros on human divers and seeing how they did that. The human divers were also collecting a lot of information for us on what crown of thorns starfish looked like, so we could identify the crown of thorns starfish no matter what the circumstances. So even if it was covered by coral or in a crevice somewhere, that's where human divers actually have a big advantage over robots, because we just have to turn our head and we can, you know, maybe see some of the hidden starfish. That's much harder for a robot to do, but it's very important that we clear all of the starfish, or there's no point in having done the control program at all. And so this is our first test of the robot. In seeing these pictures, it's actually tethered, but that was just a condition of our permit. It doesn't need to be tethered. It's doing all of this onboard processing of all of the visual information that it has, identifying where the crown of thorns starfish is, collecting its own map, figuring out where it has to go next, all using just its onboard computer processing power, which is pretty powerful. Only a few years ago, we would not have been able to do this. The robot's not particularly big. And why this is exciting is because we think that, you know, we can use robots not just for environmental protection, like this robot, but what's happening, it's very exciting right now, up on the reef, is that we're looking at using the next version of this robot, which we call RangerBot, to actually help plant coral. So it's coral spawning season up north at the moment, and so we've sent 5 of our RangerBot robots up to the Great Barrier Reef, and the idea is that they're going to collect some of this the material that the corals spawn, called larval, and we're actually going to transport it to where it can grow. Because the temperature of the ocean has increased, what that means is where corals are spawning is actually not where it's good for those coral babies to grow. It's become too warm. So you actually need all of those coral babies to move a couple of hundred kilometres south, and then they can spawn. So essentially what we're trying to do to help restore the reef is actually help the reef move south much more quickly than it could do on its own. Because otherwise, you know, as you're probably aware, we're really in danger of losing our Great Barrier Reef altogether. And so this is a way that we can help combat climate change and actually use robots to help scale the efforts that really are just impossible for people to do on their own. Now, another interesting application of robotics is in the logistics space. So has anybody ordered anything from Amazon? Hopefully you get it before Christmas. So Amazon is actually now one of the world's largest robotic companies, and that's because about 8 years ago they purchased a company called Kiva Robotic Systems that developed these orange robots, and they purchased them for, I think, $750 million. You can see these robots look like large orange Roomba vacuum cleaner robots. On the floor there, you might not be able to pick it up, but there's actually QR codes all along the floor. So the robots don't even have to be particularly intelligent. As long as they can pick up the QR code, they know exactly where they are in the warehouse. They can sense where the other robots are. You can see what the robots do. You can see one's giving way to the other one there. They actually go in under the shelf, and then the middle part of the robot actually jacks up, picks up the shelf, and then moves it to wherever it needs to go. And so that means that you can completely redesign how your warehouse looks. Although I must say, Amazon doesn't call them warehouses. They call them fulfillment centres. So this is an Amazon fulfillment centre. And the only area where you have humans in this fulfillment centre is in the very first task, where you stow items onto those shelves, and the end task, where you pick items off the shelf and you put them in a box, and that's what makes up your Amazon delivery, okay? So you can see that then they don't have to worry about where the shelves are, because the robots know where all the shelves are, and as long as they can get to the shelves, they don't have to have aisles that are a certain width apart. They don't have to have, you know, certain height restrictions, because a lot of those things are all constrained around people. But if you don't have people going in there, then you don't have to worry about that. You might also notice that those shelves are completely randomly stacked. They don't just have a shelf of paper towel or a shelf of books, because it doesn't matter, because the robot knows where everything is. And it's actually much more efficient. You use up less space if you just throw anything in anywhere. And so typically what will happen if you've ordered something from Amazon is that there will be a packing list. The robots will go off to find everything on your packing list. There will be a person who stands stationary in one spot, and the robots will start coming past with your order. So one robot will come past with one of the items on the packing list. The person's role is to reach in, pick that item up off the shelf, put it in the box. Then the next robot comes past. The next item gets picked and put in the box until enough robots have come past that they've, you know, delivered everything that you've put on your order. The person closes the box, and that's what gets shipped to you. So Amazon asked the question of, how they could actually make this completely so that there are no people. And before you feel too sorry for the people that do that picking and stowing task, it's actually a really repetitive task to be doing standing there for 8 hours a day. And at the same time that Amazon has now increased their robot population up to 100,000, they've actually employed 300,000 people. So it's just a matter of taking people away from some roles and finding other roles for them. But this is a particularly difficult task, because there is one thing that robots come nowhere near humans in terms of, and that is we have these absolutely amazing things on the end of our arms called hands. And there is absolutely nothing in robotic technology that comes anywhere near the amazing dexterity that we have with our hands. And, you know, I can't see that there would be anything like that at least for 30 years. So what that means is that for that stowing and picking task, that's a very difficult task for a robot. But our centre actually got some claim to fame in winning what they called the Amazon Robotics Challenge to demonstrate how a robot might be able to do that. And we did that using some kind of clever computer vision techniques, which allowed the robot to identify what the items were. We had to redesign the shelving system so it actually is on the floor rather than up high, much easier for the robot to reach. And so we found a way to resolve that issue. It'll be some time before that would be able to be implemented at scale. The other thing that I wanted to talk to you about today is about social robots. So unfortunately I couldn't bring Pepper, which is the social robot pictured in here today, with me, but I will take you on a tour of our robotics lab with Pepper, but you'll have to do that virtually. So Pepper is an example of what we call a social robot. Now, a social robot is a robot that has no other purpose than to interact with people. So a lot of the other robots that you've seen, you can see do very manual tasks. They move things from A to B, they pick things up. Pepper does none of that. So Pepper has these wonderfully expressive hands, and that's exactly what they're used for. They're used for expression so that she can better communicate with people. Pepper's hands are actually very limited. They only operate like this, so you can almost put something in there, but you wouldn't ask Pepper to go and get you a cup of tea. But where Pepper can be useful, or any social robot can be useful, is that you'll probably feel reasonably comfortable with talking to Pepper. So if you wanted a cup of tea, you could ask for one and Pepper could tell the tea-making robot to go and get it. Because the tea-making robot doesn't have any personality at all. And doesn't need to have it, because all it's doing is making tea. So the idea is that these robots, if they needed to, could get tasks done, but that would be by using other robots. And in fact, I think that is the key in terms of probably allaying people's concerns about robots, in as much as robots can be really good at one task, but they are absolutely terrible at stringing tasks together, which is exactly what people do and exactly what most jobs involve. It's not about just doing one task. It's about actually doing a range of different tasks and seeing how those all get put together. So some of you might have heard that there was an artificial intelligence called AlphaGo that beat a human champion of the game Go. And a lot of people were, loudly being concerned about the robot apocalypse that this was going to cause. Because I guess for some people they felt, well, this was showing that robot intelligence or artificial intelligence had become, superior to human intelligence. But if the champion of that Go competition had turned around and challenged the robot to a game of poker, it would have been a different story, because the robot would have had absolutely no ability to adapt and to do that new task. It had been trained up on a billion different Go games, but that was all it was good for. And I don't think I would struggle to think of anything that people do that really only involves one task. So this is an example of Pepper operating in Brisbane. So this is Pepper at the Department of Transport and Main Roads. And the application that this robot is using is probably its most simple form, which is called a concierge application. So what the robot does is it's there to answer questions. It has some capability to do voice recognition, but in a noisy environment it can have trouble telling different voices. So you can also use the touch screen. In this case, because it's a government department, Paul Pepper had a fairly unexciting role in terms of telling people what to do if they wanted to renew their driver's license, and so often the response ended up, after you'd gone through several layers of questions, to go to the counter and get a number. But you can imagine that if you're answering the same questions every day, after a while it can be quite wearing. And that's where a concierge app can be handy, because robots are infinitely patient. And you can keep asking them the same question all day, every day, and they are never going to get tired of answering it. Now, this is important in areas like healthcare, not only when you're dealing with the public, but, for example, when you're dealing with patients with dementia, who can often forget that they've had their questions answered and get quite agitated when people start to lose their patience and not answer the question, even though it has been answered 20 times previously. That's not a problem with a robot. The robot can keep answering the question. We're actually running a trial at Townsville Hospital at the moment with a very simple concierge app. And so a lot of our healthcare professionals spend their time answering questions like, where can I get a coffee? Where do I pay for parking? Where can I get a smoke? Unfortunately, that's still a very common question. So if you work for Queensland Health, what that then means is that you can't just say, I'll just whip out the back, that's where you can get a smoke. You actually then have to give the person a bit of counselling about smoking, direct them to Quitline, maybe suggest that they try a nicotine patch. So after doing that 20 times a day, you can imagine how you probably feel the next time a smoker comes and asks you where they can get a smoke. You're probably finding it a bit wearing. So again, this is an area where a robot can maybe take away some of that friction by just being able to answer the questions that come up all the time. Now, one thing that these concierge apps don't really show, and I don't think we have the volume on this, but essentially Pepper here is talking about how if you link, you can link Pepper up with an artificial intelligence like IBM Watson, and when you do that, that essentially means that she can register about 800 million pages a second of information. And what that allows you to do is then have these robots operate, a bit like I was talking about the more industrial robots, in unstructured environments, so being able to respond to unstructured conversations. So it's one thing for those concierge robots, if you were to ask them where you could get a coffee, and then before the robot had finished speaking, ask where you could get a smoke, then the robot actually has no capacity to respond because it's busy telling you where you can get a coffee and it's not listening to you asking your next question. When you link it up with an artificial intelligence, then you can actually introduce a lot more flexibility. The robot can actually stop what it's answering a particular question and can answer more unstructured questions. So at the moment with these applications, it's often quite limited. If you ask the question a question that the robot's not expecting, then it will be unable to answer. But once you introduce artificial intelligence, you can make them a lot more useful. This is because I couldn't bring Pepper in, this is actually a little glimpse into our lab, which is just here at QT Gardens Point. We've had to speed it up because Pepper is painfully slow. But this is Pepper. We've got Pepper doing a tour of our labs. So here Pepper's actually describing Harvey, our capsicum picking robot, and not only describing Harvey, but actually giving Harvey instructions and getting Harvey to demonstrate how it picks capsicum off our lovely fake capsicum plant. And then Pepper's about to move to our robot, which is called Cartman, which is the robot that we won the Amazon Robotics Challenge for. And she's going to she's going to describe about the Amazon Robotics Challenge, and then she's actually going to ask you to decide what item you would like the robot to pick up, and then she's going to give instructions to that robot to do that. But you can see Pepper has a wonderful, she's got beautiful big eyes, she uses her hands to give expression. all of these cues are to try and get you to believe that the robot is animate. And what we know is that people respond to what we call embodied technology much more than they do to any other technology. What that means is you are much more likely to listen to a robot that looks like Peppa than you are to any advice that you get from an iPhone app or from an iPad. Now, that's quite powerful, and this is where social robots in the future are likely to have a lot of uses, because we can then use it for what we call robotic nudging. That's getting people to make the decisions we want them to. Now, that can be used for good, in which case we're trying to do up at Townsville Hospital, we're trying to encourage people to consider getting the flu vaccination, because it has a huge impact on the number of influenza cases that we have. But a lot of people don't recognise the importance of the vaccination. So it can be used for good, so for things like public health education, to encourage people to maybe reduce their sugar intake or to stop smoking, but it can also be used for selling you stuff. And we haven't seen this in Australia much, but if you travel in any other parts of Asia, you will often see robots used in shops, and there their primary objective is to manipulate you into getting buying things. So we're going to have a fundamentally different relationship with robots, I think, when we actually start to see them used in retail. But, you know, I think that's just the way that we'll also be able to see a lot more about the limitations of the robots and get a sense of, hopefully, how you're unlikely to be threatened by them in terms of your job anytime soon. But what we do know is that there are likely to be unexpected impacts. So where people think of robots in use in manufacturing, often what we don't think about is their use in front office functions. And I think we're going to see that happen much more commonly, but as an adjunct rather than as a replacement to people. And I know my time is almost up, but, you know, there are some pretty remarkable things that we can do with robots. So this is a robotic exoskeleton. So this is someone who has been confined to a wheelchair, actually being able to use this robotic technology to move around. It's still very early days for this technology, so it's not the most comfortable, like it's not easy for someone to put on, but you know, this is the first generation of a lot of this technology, so I think we've got a lot to look forward to. And just to finish off, we often ask this question about how robots are going to impact on people, but you know, does anyone wonder how people are going to impact on robots? This is a robot in a shopping centre, and as you can see, the children are being very cruel to the robot. What they found was that the robot was far more at risk when it was confronted with groups of small people, children, with no adult supervision. And so to try and alleviate that risk to the robot, it's a fairly simple robot, but it could understand basically between little people and big people. So they programmed it so that whenever it saw a group of little people heading its way, it would head for a big person. And that seemed to correct the problem. But I think at some point we also kind of have to ask ourselves, if we do respond to this embodied technology, do we have some responsibility to treat that embodied technology with the sort of respect that you would a person? And finally, you know, technology can change fast. It was only 10 years ago that's what a self-driving car looked like. That was one of the very first ones. And in only 10 years, we have a Tesla, which is not quite safe or legal to drive, to let drive itself at the moment, but it is essentially a self-driving car. So that's quite remarkable. And I know my time is up, but I thought I would just show you some clips that I often show, and it's a bit tongue-in-cheek, but when you do worry about whether robots will take people's jobs, this is of some of the most advanced robots in the world competing in a DARPA challenge. The robots had to... They were trying to simulate preventing the Fukushima nuclear meltdown. So they had to be able to drive a car, get out of a car, walk, open a door... Yeah, not so much. Climb over some rubble, climb up some stairs. They actually, if in reality they would have needed to have climbed a ladder, no robot could do that. And a lot of these robots, they're worth $1 million. So what you don't see in this clip is after each of these robots had their fall, there'd be a whole team of 20 people that would rush out with a stretcher and go out and get it. Yes, it also had to close a valve and use a electric drill. So, yes, at the moment, this is where the technology's at. These are the most advanced, you know, technologically advanced robots in the world. Still got a few issues to iron out. And just to finish off, I mean, we're doing some fantastic stuff in robotics in Australia, and we should be very proud of what we're doing. You know, our sole aim in developing these technologies is actually to enhance human capability. We think that in the future that there will be different jobs. Some jobs may disappear, but there will be actually more jobs created by robots than are going to be taken away. And I think that's something to look forward to. Thank you.